Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
This is our third discussion in terms of geopolitics, timed to as a prequel to the 120th anniversary of Sir Halford Mackinder's famous 1904 lecture on it. And as you've heard, and I hope you've listened to the two previous ones, and I apologise for having a persistent sore throat, what we're trying to do is, instead of doing the usual unreflective geography is destiny, we're trying to actually be more informed, more thoughtful about geopolitics as a rhetoric of power and commentary, as much as a description of some real freestanding entity. And we took ourselves last time up to World War One, and I used the opportunity to suggest the need for some caution about Mackinder's idea of a kind of Eurasian pivot and heartland. And it's quite interesting to note that, in more specific terms, the geopolitics predicted prior to World War One were not to the fore during the conflict in other respects as well. For example, there'd been much discussion prior to the war about Germany's Berlin to Baghdad rail project, and the idea being that this would offer a possibility to, as David Fraser, a special correspondent for The Times, put it in a book of 1909, he referred to it as the shortcut to India. He wrote, a great rival is penetrating into our commercial preserves and establishing himself over against a position which all the world envies us, which was a reference to India. And Fraser saw the motivation for this train line as strategic, not economic. He argued that the project would hit British prestige and influence, and added that it would be worrying if the railway fell either under Germany or indeed a hostile Russia. He wrote, "We might very well wake one morning to find that Russia has bought the Baghdad Railway and indeed linking it up with her Transcaucasian system. A remote contingency, no doubt, but one which not so very long ago was regarded as worth discussion in political circles in Europe. The very thought of it smells of war." And indeed, it was possible to see this as a German Weltpolitik, world politics, that was a rail-based geopolitics, different to the naval race with Britain, which attracted so much contemporary attention, enabling Germany to breach any geographical attempt to limit it on land to Europe, to reach through its leading ally, Austria, into the Balkans, then to benefit from the geopolitical possibilities offered by the far-flung Turkish Empire, which reached to the Persian Gulf at Basra, and reached where indeed a German company was granted a Turkish concession to build a line there in 1899, and also reached down the Red Sea, along what is now the western littoral of Saudi Arabia, where indeed the Turks were also building a railway down towards their possession in Yemen. So in other words, looking at the map of the world, here we are, geopolitics, etc., etc., etc. Well, reality was rather different. The Berlin-Baghdad line was both incomplete prior to the war, not able to be completed during the war. It helped in the movement of Turkish troops and supplies within Anatolia, the area that was complete, but it wasn't able to determine strategy nor operations. Indeed, rather than the transcontinental lines, rail lines that had attracted so much attention in terms of geopolitical speculation, such as the Trans-Siberian line that Mackinder wrote about, it was in fact domestic systems of a much denser type, those that, for example, enabled France to move troops back from Lorraine in order, the Lorraine front, in order to concentrate near Paris for the Marne counteroffensive in 1914, or the British system, which helped in the mobilization of a military and creation of a military industrial complex during World War I and its German rival. These were the rail systems that were really important. And geopolitics, as the idea of far-flung map gazing, really wasn't helpful. It's true that the Germans were able to benefit from a rail-linked block of territory once they had conquered, with their Austrian and Bulgarian allies, Serbia in 1915, most of Romania in 1916, and much of Western Russia in 1915 to 1918. And the occupation of Romania in particular provided direct control over very desirable raw materials, particularly oil and grain. And this gave the Germans great potential, not least to offset the highly damaging British organized naval blockade. So from that point of view, you might argue one for Mackinder, but the reality was it didn't work. And in the event, the oceanic transport systems that he had argued were on their way out, these were the ones that were more successful during First World War, whether it was the French being able, by maintaining control in the Western Mediterranean, to move their troops from Algiers to Marseille and then upwards, so that the French Army of Africa could play a major role on the Western Front, whether it was the oceanic transport systems that provided articulation for the British formal and informal empires, trade coming in, goods coming in from, for example, Canada as formal empire, or Latin America as informal empire, and also the means to draw on, I mean, they were sold them at high cost, American resources, all of them proved significant to eventual Allied victory. More specifically, the geopolitics underlying German policy in 1914 proved flawed. Concern about a Russian threat, which the German General Staff was increasingly concerned about prior to the war, and which encouraged them to locate more troops on the Eastern Front than Alfred von Schlieffen would have considered desirable, proved misplaced. Indeed, the Russian offensive against Germany totally failed in 1914. Germany conquered Russian Poland in 1915. In 1917, two revolutions greatly weakened Russia. And in 1918, it accepted terms that left Germany dominant and able to transfer forces westwards. All this was achieved at a relatively modest cost to Germany compared to the much greater effort required for Germany's unsuccessful war with the Western powers in 1914 to 18 and with the Soviet Union in 1941 to 45. I mean, it's worth noting that in January 1918, Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, had suggested that the Allies help anti-Bolshevik movements in Russia, which was, of course, a Mackinder idea, although he didn't originate it, arguing this might do something to prevent Russia from falling immediately and completely under the control of Germany while the war continues. He argues a Germanized Russia would provide a source of supply which could go far to neutralize the effects of the Allied blockade. When the war is over, a Germanized Russia would be a peril to the world. But of course, that was not what had appeared to be the likely case to the German General Staff in 1914. Indeed, the geopolitics that influenced the German General Staff, supposedly the most effective army planners of the period, were crude, poorly conceived, inadequately executed, and a curious hodgepodge of detailed operational planning and flawed strategic assumptions, which I think can also be seen as the case in World War II. Thus, for example, in both 1914 and 1917, the costs of bringing Britain and America respectively into the war were discounted in the furtherance of bold planning to knock France and Britain respectively out of the war. And of course, what's interesting is bringing in Britain and America into the war proved more serious as a problem for Germany than the challenge posed by Russia, which is what they had concentrated much more strongly on in 1914. I think it's fair to say, in contrast, strategy and operational planning were more closely in alignment for both Britain and France. As with so much else, World War I provided transformational opportunities. Indeed, the possibilities that Balfour commented on, that there might be a German-Soviet alignment, however forced, as occurred in 1918, was one that was of significance thereafter, with links between the two powers in the 1920s and an alliance from August 1939 to June 1941. But this was not due to any geopolitical determinism and inevitability. It instead arose from particular contingencies. It's worth bearing in mind that alliance between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, which in many senses was counterintuitive and was not to last, the two being interesting as points to make, was strongly supported by Germany's leading geopolitician, Karl Haushofer, 1898 to 1946, who'd been a senior army officer in World War I. He believed that such an alliance offered Germany security from a two-front war, which had been its fate in World War I, as well as access to vast natural resources, spatial mass, and an alliance against Britain. And indeed, you could say that that very much underlay the German policy in supporting the Bolsheviks and encouraging them, though it's worth bearing in mind that the Germans also supported Irish republicanism, just as the Germans tried to stir up Islamic opposition to the British Empire in India and in the Middle East. In other words, encouraging subversion was not something that was geopolitically defined and determined, but something that was an obvious point and proposition. Encouraged in part by German intervention in 1917, the Russian Revolution was followed by foreign intervention in the subsequent Russian Civil War. And that, again, is an interesting aspect of what you could see as the geopolitics of the period. Mackinder indeed proposed a buffer states to try and contain the Soviet Union and also to try and act as a, as it were, a restraint on the idea that it'd be either the Soviets or the Germans, or even more disastrously, something that he'd been concerned about earlier in 1904, Germany allying itself with Russia. So the anti-communists supported the creation of Czechoslovakia, Poland, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, and the expansion of Romania, Greece and Serbia, all in order to create an Eastern European barrière de l'Est against Bolshevism. It's also the case of intervention in the Russian Civil War, which personally involved Mackinder in 1919 to 1920. And the Anglo-French military and political support for the new states was a key aspect of what his new order, his international new order. He was convinced of the threat posed by communist expansionism, and as High Commissioner in South Russia, he pressed the British cabinet in January 1920 on the danger of what he called a new Russian Tsardom of the proletariat, in other words, drawing on both the traditional and the new language of opposition to the Russians, and of, quote, Bolshevism sweeping forward like a prairie fire, quote, towards India and, quote, Lower Asia. Emotive language. I mean, clearly the Soviet Union was interested in trying to weaken the British Empire, but the actual capacity that it had to do so at that point can really be queried. There was a general tendency to see anti-imperial rebellions in the British Empire as part of a global communist conspiracy that had to be stopped. That very much joined Agatha Christie with Mackinder, who was knighted in 1920. It was certainly the intention of the Soviet Comintern, but as a realistic guide to Britain fighting a new war to try and control the vast space of Russia, it was less wise. And indeed, the intervention in the Russian Civil War failed. In large part, this failure was because of the weaknesses of the anti-communist white forces in Russia, notably their severe internal divisions and their grave and persistent political and strategic mismanagement. So in other words, you might focus on geopolitics and military blocs, but you have to actually look at the strategic and military capabilities and competence of them. And thus, the British General Staff report of July the 22nd, 1919, which went to the cabinet, was very different in its tone to Mackinder. It was pessimistic about the prospect for Anton Denikin, the white commander in the south, which was the area that Mackinder was active in, modern-day Ukraine, writing, unless he can offer, this is Denikin, unless he can, not Mackinder, unless he can offer to the wretched inhabitants of the liberated districts conditions of existence better than those which they suffered under the Bolshevik regime, he will in the course of time be faced with revolt and hostility in his rear, just at a time when the Bolsheviks will be concentrating large numbers of troops for a counter-offensive. Indeed, British officers on the ground were very depressed by the corruption, weakness, and attitudes of the White camp. And the collapse of the Whites helped make foreign intervention redundant. It was pressed, of course, as I've mentioned, by Mackinder. It was pressed also by the Secretary of War, Winston Churchill. But this intervention faced the legacy of World War I in the shape of financial burdens and a widespread wish for demobilization. And the latter was an aspect of the degree to which resources do not exist in the abstract. Moreover, Britain had a range of commitments, including in Ireland, Iraq, and Egypt, as well as in India. The British withdrawal from intervention in the Russian Civil War culminated when the Georgian port of Batumi on the Black Sea, where the British had landed troops in late 1918, was evacuated in July 20. And this was the final abandonment of Mackinder's call for the British to hold the rail line from there to Baku on the Caspian, a position that he presented as supporting British interests in Persia, Iran, as well as being inherently significant due to the line's major role in oil extraction. But it was a case of Mackinder being a very foolish and feckless drawer of lines on the map. The fate of the Caucasus indeed underlined some of the problems because, the British not only had to confront the Soviets, who rapidly took over subsequently Azerbaijan, Armenia and Georgia, but also the fact that Turkish opposition to Britain was growing under Kemal Ataturk and was going to threaten the route through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus to the Black Sea. There's not much point drawing a line saying the British ought to be in the Caucasus without thinking about that. And there were no effective rail routes across Persia that the British can control. And while the British saw the states in the Caucasus as a buffer for their interests in Iraq, Persia and India, they had to face the fact that the Turks in Azerbaijan, Muslims, were opposed to, Christian Armenia, etc., etc. So there was a degree of naivety about Mackinder. And I think that that is something that was worth thinking about. You know, as you may know, there's the alleged tension between reality and idealism is one of the binary divides that geopoliticians regard as a defining characteristic. But it seems actually that Mackinder was more on the side of idealism, and indeed, you know, something he wrote about in 1919, than necessarily being realistic. Another geopolitician of the period, much less attractive, much more murderous, well, murderous, Mackinder wasn't murderous, was the Soviet leader Lenin, whose prospectus for Eurasia was a very different one. In the second edition of his Imperialism, which was published in 1918, Lenin developed a sort of form of reverse heartland thesis, insofar as the heartland was presented as vulnerable from the periphery. It was presented as the Western colonial powers was the heartland, and Lenin argued that the colonial areas, notably in Asia, were a soft underbelly of the West. Now, that again was a fantasy in many respects, because in this period, although there were challenges to Western rule, they were on the whole contained, for example, in India. But it shows the plasticity of what one might call geopolitical ideas. Lastly, before we press on, if I might underline the unreality of Mackinder. In the book I've already referred to, his Democratic Ideals and Reality, A Study in the Politics of Reconstruction, which was published in 1919, the year of the Versailles Peace Settlement, he suggested joint Anglo-American trusteeship of the key naval positions of Singapore, Aden, Suez, Malta, Gibraltar, and Panama in order to ensure the peace of the ocean. Now, such notions are just fanciful. To argue that they were later to be elements of cooperation during the Cold War and that Mackinder was therefore prescient is ridiculous, because actually in 1919 he was clutching at straws more than offering an effective guide to policy. The three main naval powers, Britain, America and Japan, which was now the third naval power, they were none of them interested in handing over or sharing control over key naval positions. And instead, navalism was taken forward by the Washington Naval Treaty, an attempt to fix the size of navies, which was a very different procedure to what the geopolitical one that Mackinder had talked about. Graham, I wonder whether you would like to intervene.
Well, I would indeed. And I'd like to start, if I may, Professor Black, by thinking about the planning of the First World War and what it owed to geopolitical considerations. You've got Alfred von Schlieffen's plan of 1905, so something that's planned really just a short period after Mackinder's famous lecture. I don't know if von Schlieffen was even conscious of Mackinder's thinking, but I wonder if in that period from the von Schlieffen plan through to its modifications by von Moltke and others, whether geopolitical thinking started to have a consequence for German First World War planning, particularly on that initial push through the Low Countries and France before then turning to face east.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, one might argue that all strategy is inherently geopolitical. And you might argue that in a sense, strategy entails fundamentally a prioritization between potential challenges and potential tasks. And since the challenges and the tasks exist in physical environments, therefore you could adopt a geopolitical stance to those. But that, in a sense, is redefining strategy as geopolitics. And I'm not sure I would necessarily go as simply as that. I think that in many senses, what is striking, if you look at the language and ideas of the German General Staff, is first of all, there is a historicism. So Schlieffen himself had written on the Battle of Cannae, Hannibal's most decisive victory over the Romans, which was, of course, a matter of the tactical deployment of the troops on the battlefield. And he was trying operationally to repeat that against the French. In doing so, he discounted what we might call broader strategic questions, such as the possibility that Britain would be brought into the war, and also the possibility, which is ironic because he was thinking of Cannae, that despite a major French defeat, which in fact didn't occur, but despite that, that the French would go on fighting, which indeed was the case. I mean, you could argue that they did have a defeat and that they lost a lot of territory, although not Paris, but they went on fighting. So there is a degree of strategic failure on the German part, but I wouldn't put that down necessarily to geopolitics. I would put it down to, in a sense, the reading of operational success as having a strategic consequence. And one could take that a stage further and saying that the operational level of war, you know, is the one that is often the more easy one to describe, define, and plan for on the map, but that it can tell you how you might be able to win a campaign or a battle, but not necessarily how you're going to be similarly successful in a war.
And the question of using Germany's advanced rail network, moving troops and resources around quickly from west to east and later back again, compared to Britain's naval use of power, the thinking would be simply that, you know, if Britain is perhaps, if it gets involved in war in Europe at all in 1914, it's going to be primarily as a naval force. Naval forces is discounted as wrongly as it transpires, as you rightly say, as having less immediacy and potency than use of railways. Is that a kind of geopolitical bias towards the railways that influences German thinking?
Well, I mean, you could argue it's an institutional one, that German policymaking, military policymaking, is overwhelmingly dominated, as was to be the case in World War II, by the army, not the navy. And that this is a matter of the nature of the German elite, the nature of military emphasis, the degree to which the navy doesn't appear to have much to offer other than in war with Britain, which is not the prime interest for the army. I mean, you could, if you want to, call that geopolitics, but you might as well call that the consequences of strategic culture and force structure. Again, you've got the same sort of thing in the tensions within Japanese policymaking in 1940-1941 between the army's emphasis on conflict in China and confrontation with the Soviet Union and the navy's interest in an expansionist policy in the Western Pacific and in Southeast Asia. Now, you might say these are read through into different areas on the map, but it's not a reading of the map that leads to these differences, if you see what I mean.
And these map readings from a geopolitical perspective, they don't take account of unforeseen events and the need to respond to them. So events like the Easter Rebellion in 1916, wasn't foreseen by the German planners in before the war, or indeed the collapse of the of Tsarist Russia wasn't foreseen. So
can I just say those are comparing two very different scenarios. The collapse of Tsarist Russia was really pretty fundamental. The Easter Rising has consequence of great consequence for later Irish history, post-war Irish history. But in military strategic terms during the war, it's a non-event because the British are able to retain control of Ireland without having to have a significant military presence in 1917 or 18. It's not as though they're having to fight an insurgency war there at the same time that they are engaged on the Western Front. So I think one has to be careful here. And, you know, this may be an unattractive thing to say, but we should always be willing to consider that. But if you are interested in counterfactuals, you could say that the harsh but firm, and after all, these people were traitors fighting, you know, aligned with Germany, when Irish, far more Irish troops, both Catholic and Protestant, were fighting on the Western Front. You might say that the execution of these traitors may well have helped to stabilise the situation in the short term.
I want to move on to Bolshevik Russia, and to ask about the what had been called the Great Game, and really how far early Soviet thinking was involved in an ongoing relationship with interest in taking northern India from Britain. You indicated, you know, it wasn't at the center of Soviet strategy, but was it still part of their thinking, or really had they just simply more important things to worry about at a time of civil war and strife and famine and so on?
Well, no, I mean, Lenin was very, very interested in Soviet expansionism, and there were obviously communist movements in Europe. There was Belakun in Hungary. There were communist risings within Germany. There was the hope that the Soviets would be able to conquer and thus take over Poland. Those were at the forefront of Soviet interest, far more so than the interests that they did have at stirring up rebellion and dissent within the European empires, which particularly meant the British Empire, because Britain was the major opponent of the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But I think one's got to put things in perspective. Yes, the Soviets were interested in India. No, it wasn't a forefront of their interest. Insofar as they were interested in Asia, they were much more interested in China, where they saw the Kuomintang as allies against the British in the early and middle 1920s, and took active steps to try and train their army and to try and use them against British interests in Guangzhou and then Shanghai and Nanjing. And they backed the Northern Expedition. And it was therefore a major blow to Soviet interests when Chiang Kai-shek turned against the communists. India, compared to that, was a relatively limited consequence.
Mm-hmm. And finally, in terms of Soviet Russian interest in Asia, is there much evidence that the development of the rail network in Russia had that geopolitical or geostrategic goal of being able to move troops and resources towards China, if not towards India too?
When are we thinking about here? During the Tsar?
In the immediate years after the revolution, so the 1920s.
Well, in the 1920s, the most important determination, desideratum, is repairing the damage, which had been immense, during the Russian Civil War. There is then, obviously, the attempt to develop the Soviet economy. And as so, for example, the rail construction around Magnitogorsk, on which there's interestingly enough a new book on Magnitogorsk, and the, you know, the attempt to develop a sophisticated iron and steel industry outside the traditional areas in the Donbass and so on. I wouldn't say myself that the rail building of the 1920s was specifically linked to military mobilization. And I would argue that the Soviet Union becomes more concerned to prepare for war from the early 30s on, and initially, of course, against Japan. They've already got the Trans-Siberian. They try and improve the Trans-Siberian. But I would say it's not that rail enables a new geopolitics. It's that they are particularly concerned about the prospect of Japanese expansionism in Manchuria. They are also concerned that the Chiang Kai-shek regime, having thrown off the communist link and having succeeded in the Northern Expedition and taken control of Beijing, they're concerned that it might move into Manchuria. And as you may know, there is a short war between the Soviets and the Manchurian government in 1929. So I wouldn't say this is dependent on railways, nor would I say it's dependent on any image of geopolitics, however conceived. It is that the Soviet Union, as indeed is the present day the case with Russia and China and North Korea, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the United States, are maneuvering in a situation in which there are a number of what one might term players, and the interaction of those is unclear, and the alignments that will arrive in terms of activity, as opposed to just saying, oh yes, we want to be chums, is unclear. So that although issues of range, which inherently is a spatial characteristic, may be very important in military matters, for example, missile systems as opposed to carrier range of carrier-borne planes, that doesn't explain the actual nature of the diplomacy that is going on. I mean, after all, North Korea at the present moment is not dangerous because of the range of its missiles. North Korea is dangerous because of the nature of its policy.
Well, we'll go on to consider at greater length such issues in later episodes. But for discussing geopolitics in the period after Mackinder's famous lecture in the period of the First World War and the 1920s, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.